to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up at 10 is Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre. And at 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news magazine from our good friends, our siblings in struggle, and the San Francisco Bay Area in Berkeley from KPFA. At 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. Those of you who have neglected to become members of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today. And now, Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Tuesday, October 7th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming right up, we have guests today. We have John Quigley, of course, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University, and the author of The Ruses for War, a book that many listeners are going to be very familiar with. He is joining us to speak about war crimes committed by the U.S. upon a hospital in Kunduz. We also will have Zahara Hector. Public citizen in a news release states that yesterday, on Wednesday, cancer patient Zahara Hexter was arrested after disrupting negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There was a protest aimed at maintaining access to affordable cancer medicines in these affected 12 nations. This, by the way, remind ourselves constantly, this is not a trade deal. This is nothing like a trade deal. This is basically the end, the final play, the end game. This is a checkmate for the corporate interests that seek to control governments and manipulate markets, manipulate laws, manipulate everything out there that remains in public hands, has now officially been privatized, and the general public is blissfully unaware of how this is going to affect their lives for the most part. Zahara, however, has taken a stand for which she, as a cancer patient, is going to die because of this. She was arrested, handcuffed, thrown in jail. We'll be hearing from her and later on in the program. Right now, we're fortunate to welcome John Quigley back to the KBOO Airways. Thanks so much for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
Well, this is what happened in Kunduz. There's simply no excuse. And the fact that this president, who has been such a crashing disappointment to many people, myself included, and in many cases has absolutely enraged me, we have the specter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and of course, it's out front of that, he refuses to apologize. It is enough to really tip a lot of fair-minded, generally calm people right over the edge. This is a war crime. Drone warfare is something the world's never seen before. We have no psychological fundament to relate this to. We don't have any way of understanding it, but one thing is clear, it's a war crime. Could you talk a bit about what makes it a war crime?
You have a war crime when The action is not directed at a military objective. The law of war is rather strange because it allows you to kill people. Killing people is fine under the law of war, as long as you're killing, you know, military people, and as long as you're going after military targets like, you know, weaponry. So that's where this event comes into play as a war crime, because it was a civilian objective.
So this is, this again, anybody could be, for that matter. We saw many times over in U.S. military operations that we can tell the militants from the from just regular citizens, because the militants are the ones that are dead. When we're looking at this, how I'm trying to understand something, that he won't apologize for this, and I wonder why not, because clearly no matter what the explanation is, this people are dead, and this a civilian target was hit, moreover a hospital. And there seems, in, you know, 30 minutes of bombing and frantic calls, that nothing happened. Is this setting a very, very dangerous precedent?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. When you have an incident that's as bad as this one, I mean, hopefully one learns from it and doesn't repeat it, but the history hasn't proven that out so well. And I mean, there are a couple of problems with the way it was conducted. To start with, the aircraft that's used is one that drops really very serious bombs. It's not just a little poof, but it's something that, you know, they can take out a building. So that means under the laws of warfare, you have to use special care if you're dropping it anywhere near where there might be a civilian objective, like a hospital. Then, as well, apparently the Doctors Without Borders people had informed the U.S. military numerous times about the existence of this. So there isn't any real doubt that there was knowledge of this hospital and exactly where it was. So that further makes it look as if it's hard to find an excuse. The other factor that could be relevant would be if there was some, you know, skirmish going on in the street next to the hospital, then that could be a military objective. And that might justify a strike, although it wouldn't justify it if the inevitable consequence of shooting is going to be to hit the hospital. So I'm straining here to find a justification for it. I'm kind of putting myself in the role of the general who gave the press conference, and I'm having trouble coming up with a plausible explanation.
Well, even say the hospital actually had been taken over by so-called militants, Taliban, and so forth. The numbers simply don't justify that the extreme response. And the thing too is that the armaments that we are bombing, people, the guns and so forth, whatever they have in the way of ordnance there, we likely sold them. The amount of weaponry throughout that is dispersed throughout the world is largely traceable back to the U.S. That's another point that we ought to take into consideration. Just to wrap up here. And regarding precedents, we are looking for a way of, if not understanding this, maybe controlling it. There must be some sort of, do we have laws as yet that might serve to rein in some of these deadly actions?
Well, yes. I mean, the United States does recognize the Geneva Conventions. And we do have procedures in place in the military to prosecute people. That's how Lieutenant Kelly got prosecuted for the My Lai killings in Vietnam many years ago. So there are procedures in place, and they are sometimes used. So that is, is something I think the U.S. military will at least look into. I don't know what the upshot will be. There's also a possibility that the International Criminal Court could get involved in this, because Afghanistan is a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and that means a war crime committed in Afghanistan falls within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. So it would be conceivable that the prosecutor there could take this up.
Thanks so much for that, John. I really appreciate the clarity. There's a lot of questions that we've asked before. It's so difficult to answer everything because of the nature of this crime. Thanks again. My guest has been John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University. And if you haven't read The Ruses of War, get it, read it. It's an important book. Thanks again. We now go to Zahara Hickshire. She is, the cancer patient whose life and death, in fact, are going to be now basically in the hands of corporate interests that seek to privatize everything and the way our medical care is delivered or not, as the case may be. Zahara, welcome to the KBOO Airways. We're so glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be able to share my story.
First up, I myself feel very strongly about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In fact, nearly got kicked out of the station permanently because of how strong my feelings were. And I expressed those feelings. It's very difficult not to if you understand exactly what this is about. It's not a trade deal. It's far from it. It's an end game in privatization. Takeover that's been going on for a long time now. Tell us what happened, why you feel, how is this thing going to affect you? People don't understand this. Cancer patients, other people with terminal diseases don't understand that this is it.
The more I learn about the TPP, the more I realize it is a real threat to accessible and affordable medicines. I've been living with breast cancer for 7 years, and right now I'm strong and thriving because I've had access to excellent medicines, including biological medicines, Xgeva, Herceptin, Perjeta. But what I found out is the TPP draft, when I was protesting, and now it looks like this will be in the final version, it has what I call the death sentence clause, and that is going to lock in monopolies for certain medications, mostly used to treat cancer, but also other diseases as well, like monoclonal antibodies. And those are the kind of biological medicines. So the death sentence clause locks in monopolies that keeps prices high. How high? As high as $100,000 a year or more. So currently, while I personally am able to have access through my health insurance and through clinical trials, eventually in the U.S. and certainly in the other countries affected by the TPP, women may be denied access to life-saving medicines for breast cancer, and patients of male and female, even children, may be denied access because of the high cost, which individuals can't afford, and even healthcare systems can't afford.
So, in places like Canada and the UK, where people do have access, there is healthcare for all, basically. How will this affect their policies?
Well, we know we have a case study from New Zealand already, which of course is a developed nation, but with the medicine Herceptin, because of the de facto monopoly on this biologic medicine, the New Zealand government restricted access to Herceptin to only 9 weeks for women who have had early stage breast cancer. And we know from the clinical trials that a full year of Herceptin is needed for the maximum benefit in preventing a breast cancer recurrence. So we know already what these monopolies cause. They mean that death, you know, the death of people because of locking in high profits, which means that healthcare systems, even in a developed nation like New Zealand, cannot afford these monopoly prices. And that's the tip of the iceberg. Imagine what women in Vietnam, Mexico, or Peru are facing in lower-income countries, and, of course, in countries without a national health system, patients are even more at risk for not having access to life-saving medicines.
So what happened to you? Said, no, thanks very much, but I don't care for this trans-Pacific partnership. And what happened to you?
Well, I found out about the death sentence clause, and so I decided to go to Atlanta. I knew there were going to be some other activists there protesting, and I decided that I was going to barge into the party that the negotiators were having. It wasn't really a party. It was really their secret negotiations on the seventh floor of the Westin Hotel, which is a huge 72-story hotel in the middle of downtown Atlanta. I had my shirt that said, I have cancer, I can't wait 8 years. 8 years is the de facto monopoly they've been negotiating. And I had a microphone and I had something to say. So what I said was I wanted to meet with the U.S. trade rep to see the secret text that they were negotiating to verify that the death sentence clause was not in there. And that the U.S. trade rep should stop pushing for a clause that only benefits the pharmaceutical industry and does not benefit the majority of regular people in this country. And then my message to the other countries was to stand